the Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our docket, Colorado Coffee Bean and Colorado Mining Co. I see counsel are set up in our first case and ready to proceed. Have you all received copies of our written procedures?
Yes.
Do you have any questions?
No.
For those of you in the audience, if any of you has a cell phone or similar device, would you please turn it off so that the attorneys are not interrupted? With that, we're ready to hear argument in Colorado Coffee Bean.
Thank you,
Good afternoon, members of the court. My name is Richard Podall, and it was my privilege to represent these franchisees in the trial court and again to represent them here on appeal. This is a case of active and intentional fraud. This is a case where the Peaberry defendants made a decision to sell franchises to the public while hiding facts that Peaberry Coffee was never profitable, had lost an average of $1 million a year for 12 years. The Peaberry defendants concealed facts that their retail stores were unprofitable and most had a history of poor performance. The facts were material and in equity and good conscience should be disclosed. They were not. 10 franchisee plaintiffs, including families, were defrauded. The law of fraud in Colorado protects innocent members of the public from being induced to invest their savings and borrow funds into a business model that has a history of failure without disclosure of material facts relating to unprofitability and performance. The trial court's express factual findings establish the liability of the Peaberry defendants for both fraudulent concealment and consumer fraud. The trial court misapplied the law to its factual findings to excuse the Peaberry defendants from the fraud they practice upon the plaintiffs in this case. We will ask that this case be remanded with instructions to enter judgment against all of the Peaberry defendants under plaintiff's fraudulent concealment claim and consumer fraud claim. The claims against Perkins Coie for fraud, aiding and abetting fraud, consumer fraud, and negligent misrepresentation have never been tried. Those claims should be remanded for trial as well. In addition, a franchisor should not be allowed to slip a jury waiver past a franchisee buried deep in a document in the last sentence of a lengthy paragraph which does not identify its existence. Damages against the Peaberry defendants should be retried to a jury, and Perkins Coie's liability should be tried to a jury in the same proceeding. In regard to the fraudulent concealment claim, the trial court expressly found the Peaberry defendants had a duty to disclose material facts about Peaberry's financial history and the performance of its stores. The trial court found defendants actively concealed these material facts. Plaintiffs had no knowledge of the true facts about Peaberry's financial history and the performance of its retail stores. The concealed facts were withheld with the intent the plaintiffs purchase their franchises ignorant of the true facts. It is undisputed that each plaintiff in this case purchased the franchise.
But the court also found, did it not, Mr. Podall, that they cannot justifiably rely on these non-disclosed?
The trial court did make that finding, and that was the basis upon which the trial court failed to or refused to allow the plaintiffs to recover in this case.
And isn't that a factual finding?
It can be a factual finding. In this instance, generally it is a factual finding. In this instance, though, the trial court stated two reasons for its finding. The first reason was that the plaintiffs were told that they would not be receiving information about Peaberry's financial information or information relating to the profitability of the retail stores. Second, the trial court interpreted the acknowledgments, disclaimers, and what it called non-reliance provisions in this case to preclude justifiable reliance. In regard to the first reason, the trial court's conclusion that a duty to discharge is disclosed by announcing that the material information which a party is duty-bound to provide will not be provided doesn't discharge the found duty to disclose the material information. There's no case anywhere that says that.
Why isn't it a reason, why isn't the only reasonable inference if somebody tells you, I won't disclose this information, that it's negative?
Well, excuse me, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
Why isn't the only reasonable inference from the franchisor's statement that we won't tell you certain information that it must be negative?
That it must be negative?
Yeah.
Well, Your Honor, the law required, once the duty to disclose is found, the law required that that information be provided. The plaintiffs in this case were deprived of what the law required that they be given, the information so they could make an informed decision. And honestly, these writings in Exhibit J, for example, where it says, we don't authorize any representation to be made, and we're not bound by any representation of profits or performance or all of that. These are our boilerplate representations. To say that there's a duty to disclose, but that a boilerplate statement that you're not getting it can discharge that duty would really put a new twist on the law of fraudulent concealment. Once the duty to disclose is found, it's only discharged by providing the information. Saying I'm not going to provide it is a breach of the duty rather than discharging the duty.
I'm still stuck, Ms. Bowe, on the finding, though, which you say is normally a factual finding. I'd say it's always a fact finding. It would go to a jury if it were a jury trial, unless the evidence was so clear to take it away from a jury. And I'm not sure if you're arguing that you're entitled to a directed verdict, but are you arguing that?
Ostensibly, pretty close, because if the trial court's two reasons are wrong as a matter of law, you cannot discharge a duty to disclose by saying, I'm not giving it to you. Okay? And on pages 10, 11, and 19 of the order, the trial court makes it abundantly clear that it is interpreting, it's not considering the disclaimers and acknowledgments and non-reliance provisions as evidence. It's interpreting the disclaimers.
Well, not interpreting that because he denied summary judgment, didn't he? I mean, if it was just relying on that as an absolute bar, wouldn't summary judgment be the remedy instead of sitting through 5 weeks of testimony?
Perhaps. And well, what Judge Robbins was thinking when he denied summary judgment, I don't know. But on three separate occasions at page 10, okay, the UFOC expressly instructed plaintiffs not to rely on unauthorized information outside the UFOC, and plaintiffs expressly state in closing acknowledgments, franchise agreements are not relying on such information. Taking together these acknowledgments and non-reliance clauses preclude plaintiffs from reasonable reliance on information outside the UFOC and franchise agreement. It is simply unreasonable to continue to rely on representations after stating in writing that you are so reliant. Again, on page 11, I cannot find in paid favor of plaintiffs on these claims without ignoring the various disclaimers, acknowledgments, and non-reliance clauses in the franchise agreements, which plaintiffs testified they read and understood. And then...
Actually, stay on page 11. Next paragraph is all the plaintiffs testify that their interest was in largely driven by their positive experience in the stores. And then he says, in light of this testimony and the multiple acknowledgments in that, so isn't there more than just the disclaimer clauses?
That sentence is the only sentence in the entire order that sets forth any fact other than the interpretation of the non-reliance provisions. And frankly, it's a tremendous leap of logic to say that just because these folks liked the Peaberry coffee product, that they would have ignored a 12-year history of million-dollar losses and gone ahead with the investment anyway. Every one of them testified at trial that they wouldn't. I don't think that really is a basis, even if we're going to be looking at a factual finding and an abuse of discretion or facts in the record not supporting it. I don't think that's record support for we're going to invest $400,000 in a franchise because we think this is a nice coffee shop. If they had known that this business is losing $1 million a year, now they can make an informed decision. But yes, that is the only statement in the order other than I am relying on the interpretation of the contract provisions. And also, I think it's important to note, and I put a lot of time and prepared this Appendix A to show the court what the Peaberry defendants tendered and what Judge Robbins wrote himself. Okay, and in Coors v. Security Life, the court recognized where a trial court wholesale adopts a proposed findings, those findings have to be closely scrutinized. If you look at what Judge Robbins wrote himself, the provision about liking coffee was part of the proposed findings. If you look at what Judge Robbins wrote himself on page 19, and this is where he makes the findings of concealment and the findings of intentional concealment and duty to disclose and all of that, he finds that it is undisputed each plaintiff executed a closing acknowledgement statement and franchise agreement that included numerous disclaimers, statements of non-reliance, and integration provisions, all of which communicated to the Peaberry defendants that none of the plaintiffs were relying on information outside the UFOC and franchise agreement, or that such information communicated in any form would not be binding. Again, it is simply unreasonable to continue to rely on representations after stating in writing that you are not so relying. Because the court could not find plaintiffs have met all of the requirements of 19.1, I must find they have not met their burden regarding the third claim for relief. So in his home writing, that's all he's relying upon, where he goes through the whole presentation of the duty to disclose, and there was a duty to disclose, and the facts were concealed, and they were intentionally concealed, and plaintiffs were innocent.
If I could ask you, and on your consumer fraud claim, I have a similar problem with that in terms of standard review. The public impact seems to me to be a factual issue. In a jury case, you would submit it under appropriate instructions to a jury and say, was there a public impact? Why is that not a fact finding?
Again, it can be, and generally is. But again, using Coors v. Security Life as an example, in that case, the trial court found public impact, and this court found based upon the undisputed facts in the record and the found facts in the record, as a matter of law, there was no public impact. And that's basically what we're suggesting here. If you do a proper analysis under Hall v. Walter, okay, and you consider actual or potential impact, you consider the trial court found lack of sophistication, and 10 people were actually affected, but you consider that the Peaberry defendants reached out and engage the public through advertising to lure them into a fraudulent concealment scheme, as a matter of law, those facts we're arguing demonstrate public impact.
So and you would be entitled in a jury case to a directed verdict on that. Is that your position? As a matter
I think
of law,
we'd be,
because the facts are so one-sided that as a matter of law, you'd be entitled to a finding on that element?
Based on the found facts and the finding, court's finding of lack of sophistication, I think in a jury trial we might be entitled to summary, well, to a directed verdict or maybe even on a motion for summary judgment. I think the factual record demonstrates public impact in this case. And very importantly, too, the trial court never went through the analysis. It noted the analysis, which we had set forth in our briefing, and then it never engaged in the whole analysis to determine
the correct legal
impact.
Standards.
Excuse me?
It articulated the correct legal standards. You're
right.
Saying it didn't apply them correctly.
Precisely. Precisely. And I would like to, that one quickly, reserve my last minute and 31 seconds, if I may. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Hugh Gottschalk. I represent the Peaberry defendants. Mr. Bauman is counsel for Perkins Coie. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes out of our 15 collective. I'll do my best to wind down and leave Mr. Baum 2 minutes. This case involved a five-week trial, a 25-page order entered by Judge Robbins, and in that order, he specifically finds that there was no intentional misrepresentation, that none of the plaintiffs reasonably relied on the alleged misrepresentations, and that there was no duty to disclose the information the plaintiffs said was withheld.
Just as a preliminary matter, do you agree that the attachment to the opening brief accurately reflects the proposed order as you drafted it, plus the trial court's additions and deletions?
Mr. Podol's red line?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Do you also agree that the list of 10 or 12 disclaimers attached to the opening brief is as far as we need to consider?
I think so, Your Honor. I think it's right. I've not found anything wrong with it because that's not the sort of focus of our argument. I don't want to stipulate to it, but I know of nothing incorrect about what Mr. Podol has submitted.
Thank you.
The essence of the plaintiff's argument is that there is some language all found in the duty of disclosure section, which confounds or is confusing to the central conclusions Judge Robbins reached. Mr. Podol's, and since Judge Webb asked about it, Mr. Podol's hypothesis is clearly that the order was sort of foisted on Judge Robbins and somehow the words that we submitted in our proposed order don't carry as much weight as the words that Mr. Podol would have submitted or the words Judge Robbins used himself.
Mr. Gottschall, while we're on that point, though, isn't the cut and paste job, it led to some inconsistencies. You talk about some findings that he made, and it seems that whether there was a duty to disclose, whether any fraudulent concealments, it seems like there's inconsistencies in terms of what he picked up from you proposed and what he edited, and it seems contradictory.
There is confusion in the language. I agree with that. I will explain to you why I think the language is not in conflict, which was your last question. But I agree with you. Some of the language that he added to our proposed order seems different than the order that he signed based on the language that we proposed. The bottom line is all of those conflicts, all of that confusion arises as he's explaining the duty of disclosure. And I believe what he was saying in that duty of disclosure is a party has a duty of disclosure if there's a false impression created in the minds of a plaintiff. And he went through and talked about, in terms of the alleged misrepresentations, his conclusions that in the context of a duty of disclosure, there were these facts, but he says very clearly, but I find, based on the disclaimers and all the evidence, that there was no duty of disclosure. And so all of that language he is tying in to Section H of his order, all related to duty of disclosure. The section dealing with reliance is headed reliance. He goes through the evidence and he concludes no reliance. He goes through the lack of intent and concludes very clearly lack of intent. And I think, Your Honors, the only way to resolve what did Judge Robbins mean is what he concluded. He concluded, although in the 25-page order there may be drifting language, there may be language that is confusing, there is no doubt what he concluded. He concluded that there was no intent, no reliance as a factual matter, and therefore a defense verdict was appropriate. I believe clearly, Your Honors, the reason Mr. Podol is asking for you to enter judgment on the language you say is confusing, Judge Connolly, is because he knows, as I believe, that if you were to remand this to Judge Robbins for further findings and clarifications, he would clean up his order and come to the exact conclusion he came to.
But why isn't, in light of the inconsistencies my colleague points out, why isn't remand the safer and more reasonable approach? Remand to clarify the order.
I guess it's safer. I don't think it's necessary. I think the standard we're talking about here is fundamentally under Rule 52, which is, has he entered findings of fact under Rule 52 that support the finding, that support his ultimate order? He clearly has entered findings of fact which support the order that he entered. Safer, I suppose, a remand for clarification would be safe. I think it is completely unnecessary given the logic of the way the order is set up and that the loose language only involves the duty of disclosure. If you were to conclude that the section on duty of disclosure is confusing, it doesn't hold together, and therefore you're concerned about it, that would make sense to me. But you have two other intact sections on reliance and intent, which by themselves carry the day and support his conclusion that the dismissal of all the claims is appropriate.
That leads to my next question, Mr. Gottschalk. That is, I'm trying to figure out which disclaimer anyone signed that disclaimed the ability to receive any information about the viability of the parent corporation as opposed to the company stores.
There was no specific disclaimer relating to particular bits of information. The language generally was a non-reliance clause basically saying we are not relying on anything else other than the official documentation. And as a result of that, the court found there was no duty to disclose other information. The logic of that particular information, Your Honor, the reason the FTC rule precludes it is because it not only is not relevant or material, it can be affirmatively misleading.
Well, are you saying that the FTC rule precluded Peaberry from giving any information indicating that it was not profitable?
It precluded the parent corporation, PCI. It precluded the parent of the franchisor from providing its financial statements.
That's not my question. Did it preclude the parent corporation from telling the potential franchisees that it was not profitable? Did the FTC rule?
I think the answer is yes, and I'm not sure the difference between your question and my last answer.
Financial statements. I'm asking about a simple statement saying we are not profitable. It would have precluded them from saying that?
I believe it would have. I'm sorry?
How? Why? What in the language of the rule says that?
The rule says that the audited financial statements cannot be disclosed unless there's a guarantee.
That those are financial statements. That's different than saying we're not profitable.
I understand, Your Honor, but my conclusion, the reason I answered the question the way I did, is if the FTC rule says you can't disclose the financial statements of your parent because they're not relevant unless you guarantee that financial statement is behind the franchising, my conclusion is I would not advise my client that they can get around that rule just by not disclosing unaudited, just by saying it's profitable. If the rule precludes financial statements showing it's profitable, I think you can't get around the rule just by saying, well, I'm not going to give you full financial statements, but it is profitable. I think the logic of that rule says the parent corporation financials are not relevant, can be very misleading to a franchisee unless there's a guarantee that ties the parent into the franchising opportunity.
Then why were they permitted to provide them with gross receipts information about the parent?
The gross receipts was about the individual stores. The gross receipts was about the individual stores.
They were owned by the parent.
They were owned by the parent, yes.
And not by the franchise.
I agree. And maybe I misunderstood your question. Clearly, they could provide and did provide information about the stores and could have provided, under the FTC rule, additional information about the stores. And maybe the disconnect, Your Honor, was I was thinking about the profitability of the parent corporation. I think clearly they could and did provide financial information about the retail stores that were owned by the parent corporation. And they could have provided profitability of those stores, but the FTC rule does not require them to.
I'm asking us about the reliance issue. Apart from these disclaimers, and I'm not sure there's any, in response to Judge Sherry's question, there's any specific disclaimer saying that you cannot rely on any profitability of the parent company. There's nothing that specific.
There's nothing that specific. The non-reliance clause and acknowledgments basically say, you have given me the formal financial information, and the I'm not relying on anything else.
Okay,
and that relates to
those non-reliance clauses. What other evidence or support is there for finding that they could not reasonably or justifiably rely on the non-disclosed information?
Judge Webb's question that there is, I mean, they had no reason to assume it was anything. Judge Webb made the hypothesis that maybe it was negative. I think the logic and the law in Colorado is you have no reasonable basis to assume it's anything. And that's
even apart from the non-reliance clauses. So there, you could never rely on an omission, or what if you're not given information, and you know you're not given information, you can never rely on the fact that the information is different.
If there was no duty to disclose, that's exactly right. If I say I want to buy something from you and ask you for information, and you say I'm not going to give you that information, I think it's clear I'm not relying on that information in making my purchase decision.
I accept that, although I think, as I read the discourse opinion, I think it is contradictory. I think if there is a duty to disclose and the information is concealed or not given, I'm talking about the reliance element, which the district court seemed to me went off primarily on they could not justifiably rely. If there's a duty and a breach of that duty, what evidence is that they can't rely on the fact that the financials are different than they assume them to be?
On the non-disclosure argument, Your Honor, if there is a duty to disclose and they were not disclosed, then you can rely on them. The issue is that with respect to the concealed information, the court found there was no duty to disclose, and in the absence of that duty to disclosure, there was no reasonable basis to rely on that they were one way or the other.
So the reliance finding is dependent on the duty finding? I read it that there could be a duty, and the district court independently found, even assuming there's a duty and a breach, there was no justifiable reliance, and you're not defending that as a standalone element?
Yes, I am justifying it as a standalone element. The issue of reliance on either the affirmative misrepresentations or the undisclosed informations, the court trial court found that there was no justifiable reliance on either the withheld information or the information alleged to be an affirmative misrepresentation. And that is a standalone element separate from the duty of disclosure, which is why the court set it up the way it did.
And that's what I'm questioning in terms of what is the factual record support for that apart from the non-reliance clauses.
Let me say one thing. Mr. Polo has not challenged the sufficiency of the evidence in this appeal. So when you asked your directed verdict questions and we got into the evidence, I think we've gotten beyond the scope of his appeal.
Well, I would suggest he may have mischaracterized it as a legal element as opposed to a factual element, but he's certainly saying that there was not adequate support for the conclusion, which I would call a finding, the conclusion that there was not justifiable reliance. I think that's, isn't that what the thrust of his appeal?
The basis for the court's conclusion that there was no justifiable reliance were the non-reliance clauses, the acknowledgments, the entire factual record. It isn't highlighted in his opinion, but he listened to all the plaintiffs testify about what they did, how they interacted, their communications with Peaberry, and based on all that evidence, he concluded, he found that they had not proven the element of reliance on either the concealment claim. Mr. Podol clearly wants to make it all about the acknowledgments, but as you pointed out in your question, Judge Connolly, the summary judgment order denied dismissal, saying there could be reasonable reliance even with these acknowledgment clauses. The only conclusion I think this court can reach is that after 5 weeks of evidence, hearing the testimony, seeing the exhibits, understanding the facts, and seeing the acknowledgement clauses, the fact finder concluded, as a matter of fact, there was no reasonable reliance. I want to make one other statement about the CCPA claim. I think the CCPA claim, the public impact, can be dispensed with as easily as there is no case in this state which finds public impact except where public advertising is deceptive. In the Hall v. Walter case, it was the public advertising was deceptive. In Rhino, the public advertising was not itself deceptive, and the court found there was no public impact. The bottom line is no matter how much the plaintiffs try to shoehorn this into a CCPA claim, there's no authority in this state for a public impact and a CCPA claim where the challenged practice is not public advertising. I think I've exceeded my time. I hope you'll indulge my co-counsel.
Just a second. Okay. We'll give Perkins Coie 2 minutes, and we'll give the plaintiffs an extra 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
My name is Fred Bauman, and I represent Perkins Coie. I will, perforce, be brief, since we're already over our time. Perkins Coie was sued at the 11th hour in this case for participating in the alleged fraud of its client, the Peaberry defendants. Exercising his discretion, Judge Robbins bifurcated the claims as against Perkins Coie from the claims against Peaberry so as to avoid the need to deal with very difficult privilege issues. The case proceeded to trial, however, under an express finding, an express ruling by Judge Robbins, that the findings of fact in the so-called Phase 1 case against Peaberry would be binding on Perkins Coie to the extent the claims overlapped, and of course they overlapped significantly. The findings of fact and conclusions of law on the claims against Peaberry preclude plaintiffs from prevailing on the claims against Perkins Coie, and so the court correctly entered judgment against plaintiffs on their claims against Perkins Coie based on the findings in the Phase 1 case. I want to talk briefly about two other issues. First is the negligent misrepresentation claim. One of the claims against Perkins Coie, like one of the claims against Peaberry, was for negligent misrepresentation. The claims against Perkins Coie are exactly in the amended complaint, second amended complaint, exactly the same as the claims against Peaberry. The findings and the entry of judgment in favor of Peaberry on the negligent misrepresentation claim against it precludes the pursuit of the same claim against us, regardless of whether this court remands against the Peaberry defendants, because Mr. Podol did not appeal the judgment in favor of Peaberry on the negligent misrepresentation claim. So as a matter of collateral estoppel, claim preclusion, that claim goes away. I've already exceeded my extra time, unless the court has any questions.
Hey, Ms. Bauman, actually, if you know, my colleagues, I'm interested in the jury waiver issue.
Yes.
And I don't know if you're there. You raised three arguments about why it was properly extended to Perkins Coie, the third of which I think is the only one the district court adopted. On the second one, you say as a matter of interpreting the franchise agreement, that the language should apply to Perkins Coie. I'm a little unclear. It doesn't apply to agents. It applies to officers, directors, and I'm wondering why, which I think is the starting point. I agree with you. The starting point is the plain language of the agreement. I'm having trouble reading that to apply to Perkins Coie.
The plain language of the agreement should apply to Perkins Coie. At least one of the reasons is if you read the provision, the paragraph 23.2, in which the jury waiver language is the last sentence. The sentence immediately before that says, in any if in the same legal proceeding, and then it goes on to talk about what it applies and the venue and the waivers, and then it goes on to say, and there shall be no jury. In context, our argument is that the in the same legal proceeding should apply to the last sentence as it does to the second to last sentence.
So the key there would be the fact that they joined you, and if they filed separately against you, then that argument wouldn't.
If they had filed a separate claim against Perkins Coie, the argument that textually it should apply because it's in the same legal proceeding would not exist. The agency argument would still exist, and I would argue that if they filed the same claims against Peaberry that they filed against Perkins, any findings in the claims against Peaberry would, of course, apply to the claims against Perkins, but that textual argument would be different. Thank you, Your Honor.
I think we've added 2 minutes to your time, so go ahead.
Thank you. In regard to the negative inference argument that Judge Webb raised immediately, I'd like to point out that that would seem contrary to jury instruction 19-9, which states that a person is justified in dealing with another, that material facts will not be withheld where there's a duty to disclose. In regard to the issue of whether a parent's information can be disclosed in a UFOC, there's absolutely nothing in the UFOC that prevents disclosure of parents' financial information. The IFA brief was very, very careful to stay within the construct of financial statements. And citation for that would be 16 CFR 436.1 and 72 Fed Reg 1544. Again, I would respectfully submit that there is no factual support in the record for the finder of non-reliance. It all goes down to the interpretation of the disclaimers, and there are several things wrong with that.
Let me ask how you respond to Mr. Gottschall's position that you haven't challenged the factual findings of the district court.
What we've said is that the district court's findings were in effect contract interpretation, and contract interpretation is a question of law. Rhino Fund recognized that. So if all the district court is doing is interpreting the meaning of these contractual provisions, it is a question of law. It's not. But you get to the same place if it's a factual finding. There's no record support for the factual finding, number one, and number two, where the factual finding is no more than contract interpretation, it becomes a question of law that's reviewed de novo, and the trial court, in this court, is not bound by the trial court's interpretation of a contract, which is one of the main premises of Rhino Fund. Another premise of Rhino Fund is you can't disclaim intentional fraud in Colorado. Maybe in Indiana, where the federal district court applied the Hardy's case, you can use an integration clause to disclaim intentional fraud. Rhino Fund says you can't do that in Colorado. Excuse me?
How about Baskin-Robbins, where the Tenth Circuit did it under Colorado law?
That's the Canole case, Baskin-Robbins v. Canole. There, the Tenth Circuit was very careful to say that the trial court did not apply the disclaimers to exculpate fraud, but rather considered the disclaimers as evidence, and it wasn't in regard to excusing a duty to disclose or exculpating fraud. It was in regard to finding a duty to disclose. The issue in Canole v. Baskin-Robbins was, is there a duty to disclose? And on that very narrow question, the Tenth Circuit said that the trial court, Judge Mache, was they couldn't find anything wrong with him at least considering the disclaimers as evidence. But applying the disclaimers to shield a fraudfeasor from liability is exactly what Rhino Fund says you can't do, and Dreiling v. Schultz says you can't do that 40 years ago. In addition, any disclaimers that were ever applied by jurisdictions that do it, such as New York, that have to be specifically matched to the facts. And there is absolutely no disclaimer that addresses the parent's financial condition in this case. So that just doesn't match. And I'd love to say a couple of more things about the CCPA, but I see my time's up and you've been very indulgent, so thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course. As soon as the tables are cleared, right?